show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Bouncing ball, Moustakas, fair ball. Sets, throws, Royals win it. Kansas City, you've got a World Series.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. We have a very special show for you tonight. As always, I am your host, Jeff Herr. With me, the dynamic and computer-averse, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing this evening?
Well, I'm fine now that we're 20 minutes behind schedule.
Yes, we at least we didn't have the Gremlins on air this time. Fingers crossed, knock on wood, type of deal.
There's a lot of wind in my apartment.
Yes, a lot of wind going around. Inside joke there, but we have a very special show because with us we have Dan Zimborski, writer for ESPN. He's done stuff for FanGraphs. He's got a lot of the Zips analysis. We're going to get into that and talk about that. But first, Dan, how are you doing?
Pretty good. A little cold, but I assume you guys are too.
Yes. And where are you from? Actually,
I'm from Baltimore, but I'm in Ohio. But they're both really cold.
Yes, both really cold. Yes, and it is freezing here in Kansas City. So I feel your pain quite literally, unfortunately. but as we get started tonight, I think first we're just gonna jump right in here. And recently, you know, there have been Zips projections that have been coming out, and Mike and I have kind of talked about this on the show before, and Mike and I have been terrible at explaining what exactly goes into Zips and kind of the goal and maybe some of its strengths and weaknesses. So if you could just kind of give the most eloquent example or eloquent explanation that you can of what Zips is and kind of how it's created and what it...
And the real explanation, not the joke one.
Yes.
Obviously, there's a lot of error ranges in this kind of projecting or any kind of projecting because predicting a future is hard. It's very foggy. The best we can kind of do is kind of reach into the fog a little and find our way. I always joke that my goal for a projection system is to be the least terrible way of predicting the future.
Yes.
Doesn't make great headlines. Least terrible, but. Predicting the future is really hard.
Well, it's like that that is a Winston Churchill quote where democracy is the worst form of government.
Except all the others.
Done to man, but it's better than all the other ones or whatever. Same kind of deal. That's what that reminds me of.
It's kind of like the avoiding the awful that you brought up about the Royals, you know, and kind of what they've done in the past where they're trying to avoid the awful transactions. And like last year there was no huge, well, I don't want to say that. Mike Moustakas was a pretty big black hole, but you know, his overall production was pretty average. But in the case of Zips, my question always kind of comes down to the interplay between some of the things like you know, the pitching projections and how they match up with the defensive projections. Because in the case of the Royals, and I kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but guys like, you know, Jeremy Guthrie and Jason Vargas are projected to be pretty average guys, and I think we've kind of expected Guthrie to be to fall off that high wire by this point. So with a team like the Royals who excel defensively, or they have historically, does that kind of work into the, like, the run saved defensively from the position players fit into the projections, or is it more of a kind of a general formula for most pitchers based on, you know, the things that they in theory can control, like strikeouts, walks, home runs, and things like that?
While the peripheral statistics are very important, I use a model that recognizes that over long periods of time, certain pitchers and certain pitchers on certain teams will be able to outperform their projections to some degree. Like if you look at my R.A. Dickey projection every year, he's always projected by Zips to beat his FIP. And so when you see the quote-unquote Zips war that I always include, in the team-by-team rundowns. It's not exactly the same as Fangraphs were because they use pure FIP. I use kind of a regressed FIP. I guess you could call it kind of almost a compromise between Baseball Reference and Fangraphs. If you asked me to design my perfect wins above replacement, for the pitchers, while I would use FIP, it would be regressed towards their ERA depending on how long they've pitched. For instance, Tom Glavine, after 20 years, we should believe he has the ability to exceed his ERA in performance more than we would Glavine 2 years in. But of course, people might not like that because we'd evaluate Glavine's performance in 1992 differently in 2000 or 2010 than we would in 1992. But I think that's probably the best way to go about it, because sometimes things we find out in the future give us information about previous things that happened. And I think the interplay between FIP and ERA is one of those things. But it might be confusing to have another war on the market because there's already significant...
Yes.
It's like, Baseball Reference War, Fangraphs uses ultimate zone rating, I hate you, I kill you! you know, these very strange arguments that people have. So the Zips projections for the Royals, it does include a pretty good credit for their defensive ability. Not to the same extreme as they performed in 2014, because the thing about defense is it's really hard to stay, you know, that far above average. Mm-hmm. Teams will tend to say that same kind of regression, because it's hard to have so many guys who are 20 runs better than average. It's hard to maintain that.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I think I'm glad you brought up the point of the different wars, because that is always, especially... I don't know. I think the internet, it's great because you can reach out and get so much more information, and you can pass that information along and find like-minded people and maybe even convert a few people. But there's always those people that are going to be yelling at you that you can't play baseball on a spreadsheet, that you can't do any of this. We have a radio host here in town, and I like that your wins above replacement is Zip War, because he I think ironically mentioned nobody cares about Zip Wars. So when
as like a flippant reference to some weirdly named stat, but it's actually something that you've created.
So how do you, like, I mean, the easy answer is you just kind of have to understand what each one means. But I mean, how do you reconcile that difference between all of those different projection systems and all those different evaluation formulas that are out there?
I mean, it is difficult. You kind of have to recognize that the reason these things differ so much, I mean, on most things they do tend to agree, but the reason there's some difference is because there's a lot of uncertainty about these things, because really even the a player's seasonal performance is in its way an estimation of their true ability. We talk about true ability, but it's such an abstract concept. It's something you can never actually answer. Mm-hmm. Like, take Alex Gordon. We know he was really, really good in 2014, but we still don't know what mystical abstract value, what his true ability is. We don't really know what his real probability is, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And going back to the pitchers in the Zips War, if you look at the projected ERA and the FIP, Zips actually projects most of the starting pitchers to have an ERA well below their FIP. Ventura was 0.2 of a run. Danny Duffy, half a run, 0.2 of a run each for, I think, both Vargas and Jimmy Guthrie. So it is taking that into consideration. And there will always be some disagreement among systems. And I think people don't like that uncertainty. But the thing is, when you have certainty, you're kind of lying about it, because nothing is that certain.
Well, yeah, it's always kind of like a moving target. I mean, one hot month can totally change a player's entire season around, and you know, one bad month can do the same. You see it all the time. So I mean, it would figure that if you have that much fluctuation within a season, then that's going to affect so many other areas. So
well, it's like Nori Aoki last year. I mean, he was, you know, a punchline for a lot of the year here in KC, but then had one of the hottest Septembers on record. And if you go back and look at his numbers, he had a decent season, but like, if you going into September, he was having a pretty poor season. So yeah, I mean, to that, it's like, what's the you know, who's the real Aoki in this situation.
It's really too bad that the Royals didn't check on those end of season numbers for him. Maybe they would have re-signed him.
I know. I would not have been opposed to that.
You would have thought they might have checked up on that at some point.
Maybe.
I'm pretty sure. I think his wife really hated Kansas City because when I think I read this comment, and I don't remember if it was on. I don't know where I saw this, but it was right after the trade, and she was like, she found out where she was going, and she asked, L.A., New York, no, Kansas City. She's like, oh, do they have restaurants there? I'm like, oh,
do they have restaurants? Only some of the best in the country.
They have steakhouses, and Japan has steakhouses.
Yeah,
they love steakhouse.
It may not be Kobe beef,
but there's steakhouses.
Yeah, we're not too glamorous here in the Midwest, but you know,
we do it well though.
It's true.
But it's interesting, Dan, that you brought up how you talked about kind of reconciling all that stuff and what do we truly know, and going back to like the Tom Glavin example, you know, versus, you know, 2 years of knowledge versus 20. I've always thought it was interesting when you've kind of heard this adage sort of that, especially for pitching, over a long enough timeline, the ERA has more predictive value than something like a FIP or whatever, because eventually, you know, they just kind of, the player kind of is what they are, if you will.
Over a long period of time. I think I calculated that the best predictor of Glavin's future ERA was something like 86% ERA, 14% FIP, something like that.
Wow.
If he came back now. I mean, he'd probably suck now, but...
I would imagine.
he's probably a little past his prime at this point.
With Questech and everything, he might not get that strike zone anymore. Oh, that's a sensitive issue to bring up with Braves fans, which I of course do.
Because naturally.
but really, it's all just an estimation. I mean, we know Lorenzo Cain hit .301 in 2014. We don't really know if he was a .301 hitter. We don't know if he was a lucky .290 hitter or an unlucky .310 hitter or a really unlucky .330 hitter or something. We don't know any of that. Really, the line is just an estimation of a player's ability.
And that's kind of, that's really intriguing to me too, because, and I've made this comment in this offseason where I look at the Royals the last 2 years and I, going into each season, and I'm going to do the same thing this year because it's just how I feel about this team, but I predicted 85 wins in 2013 and in 2014, and I'm probably going to predict it again. And I think that the Royals were an 85-win team, but in 2013 they were just about an 85-win team, but in 2014 they were a kind of lucky 25-win team who then, you know, kind of got on a roll there at the end. So, I mean, there's kind of this – it was really brought up around the World Series. It's kind of cooled off in the off season, but this idea of almost maybe a reverse money ball type of thing, that for lack of a better term, that the Royals are kind of doing, because the numbers they don't favor the Royals in terms of just, you know, player numbers and overall numbers, but the way they've structured their team with the focus on the defense and the focus on the bullpen and how those things are kind of the hardest to quantify and can fluctuate wildly, but can really turn the tide of games. I mean, is that something that has validity, or do you think, or is that something that you think the Royals were just kind of more or less, you know, a semi-lucky team last year that then got really hot at the very right time?
While there might be something to it, the effect probably isn't that large. And there's just so much uncertainty, and really just there is a lot of luck in baseball, and teams that win the World Series or get to the World Series are more likely to have been the beneficiaries of that luck. It's just the way it goes. It's one of those things we never really know. But the thing is, luck has – these kinds of overachievements kind of have poor predictive value, which suggests that even if there's something there, that luck probably has a bigger deal to do it. Now, I know that Lee Judge, who is the one I think of when I think of anti-Moneyball in Kansas City, I know he would disagree with me.
I wonder why you would think that.
But notice that Chris Getz always fared well in that anti-money ball stuff, and the Royals became good once Chris Getz left town. Makes you think.
That's interesting.
Go figure. I wonder if anyone's pointed that out to Lee Judge. And
I don't know.
Film his reaction.
No, he'd probably think that they were winning it for Getz. You know, win one for the Getzer.
Oh, it was his leadership that stuck with the team after he was gone that propelled them to further heights. That's
why he was able to leave. He taught them all the lessons he had to give.
There was nothing left to give.
It was like Obi-Wan
off into the sunset. Yeah.
Obi-Wan letting Vader hit him to propel everything else forward.
Yeah, he's just going to be a force ghost for now on, giving other lousy middle infielders tips on how not to hit for an extra base hit ever.
And he is in the front office now.
That would actually be like an awesome cartoon for Lee Judge to draw. Actually, would be Chris Getz as a force ghost.
He doesn't seem like the type that would like Star Wars. I kind of see Judge thinking, "Stupid kids with their Star Wars Trek and their glowing swords. We had metal in my day."
Yeah, he doesn't seem like the kind of guy that likes much fun. But you know, I don't know him personally, so that's just an impression.
I've heard tales, but anyway,
we won't get into that.
See, whenever I do an impression, excuse me, I ruined my throat doing a Lee Judge impression. Whenever I do an impression of like an 50s and older sports writer, I also always sound like a grizzled 1860s prospector.
Yes.
We're going to get gold, we are.
Yes. It's like Tracy Ringles being the cowboy hat.
Or like Clint Eastwood in Trouble with the Curve.
I don't want to think of that.
I remember.
I've not seen that movie, and I don't think
it was
just terribleness and apply it.
Obvious. Trying to just like go exactly against what Moneyball was, and not just from philosophy, like directly as the movie. I watched like 30 minutes of it on cable one night, and I was like, I can't do this. It's painful. I just can't do it.
It gives Troy a bad name.
Email to Mike and the worst movie ever.
And the thing about Trouble with the Curve, there was actually a lot about it. Some claimed that they had written the screenplay. Court case to decide who got to be credited with writing that.
Who got the credit for this? Oh, man, that is what a prize to be won, you know? Okay, so...
Back on track. Back to baseball.
Back baseball, yes.
We were talking baseball. Curves are baseball-related.
Yes.
Yes, curves are... And Trouble with the Curve is a baseball-related movie, so, you know, we're staying on track here.
We're in range. We're good.
but you mentioned Alex Gordon a little earlier, and let's kind of talk about him for a second. There was a big kind of an uproar around mid-season or so, because there was the I was at a game. It was the game that was suspended to be played at a later date. Alex Gordon hits a 2-run homer to tie it in the bottom of the ninth, and people start throwing the MVP chant around, and it's because at that time it was FanGraphs who came out and their WAR calculation had Alex Gordon as the best player in baseball, above even Mike Trout. but there was just kind of that media backlash, if you will, just kind of being like, well, that's, you know, the FanGraphs WAR takes defense way more into account, and so that that kind of skews the numbers. So, you know, what's your take on Alex Gordon? And your the Zips projections here have him as pretty similar to last year, which was, you know, a damn good season, but best player in baseball type of a thing. I mean, I'm guessing you're probably not on that side of the fence.
No, I probably wouldn't call it that, because while people make really stupid arguments about defensive measurements, saying that they're meaningless, like, no, they're not meaningless. They're volatile. They're uncertain. They're not meaningless. But the thing is, Alex Gordon's WAR was really based on a really hard-to-maintain level of defense. And we're not really positive, you know, extreme levels of of defensive performance. We're not really certain about that. I think he was like 25 over average or something like by ultimate zone rating this year.
Yeah,
but there's a good deal of uncertainty about that number. There's more uncertainty about a number like that than say someone that's 8 wins above replacement on offense. Offense is a more stable stat. I would personally probably average and regress defensive performance a little because of that uncertainty. I know people don't always like that idea because it's like you're not measuring it, you're projecting. But I'm like, but that's kind of what measuring this is. Measuring and projecting aren't really all that different. Just counting is, again, as we discussed before, kind of a foggy estimate of ability. So there's a difference. Do we acknowledge that our measures are foggy, or do we decide that something we can count is inherently accurate? I think Gordon's an excellent player, but he's more likely to be somewhere in the 10 to 20 runs above average range than the 25 to 30 runs above average range. And that's enough to not come out of any real MVP discussion. But it's a legitimate argument. It's not a crazy argument. Because, I mean, you're getting into kind of philosophical ends there. I know this sounds kind of new age, you know. You can't put a number on a player, man. It's foggy. Even the real numbers aren't real.
Well, that's really interesting, though, how you kind of term that, because I never really thought about it that way, that, you know, even the counting stats, you know, and they've been around in baseball for so long that, and we've kind of talked about where you know, you FIP scares people because it's weird and it's got an intense calculation involved with it. But, you know, RBIs don't freak people out because it's just a counting stat. And so it's really easy to, you know, it's telling you exactly what happened and it's based on a concrete number. Person hit the ball, runner scored, that's an RBI. I can understand that. I know what happened there. but at the same time, the way you put it, you know, RBIs, even though it's based on that kind of concrete fact of what happened and what occurred, it's still just an estimate of their true ability, because otherwise they'd have the exact same amount of RBIs every year if it was, you know, truly showing who the player was. I mean, that's kind of an interesting idea that I hadn't really thought about it that way before.
Yeah, as I said, these are all foggy estimates essentially. So really, any evaluation we make of anything, there's a good deal of uncertainty. Whether we can count it, whether we can calculate it, there's a lot of unknown out there.
So when teams are looking ahead, and general managers even, they have to kind of guess at some of these things. And from what you were talking about on Twitter yesterday, the Royals guessed pretty poorly in a lot of areas. So I want to talk about their offseason. And you called it one of the more disappointing ones in recent memory. So I guess the best question is, which of the three main signings was your least favorite between Alex Rios, Kendry Morales, and Edinson Volquez?
I think Kendry's Morales to a degree, because he wasn't even really a major league player last season. I mean, yes, he had a layoff, but you can't blame a layoff because players come back from injuries or a whole offseason and they don't have a 600 OPS. He wasn't injured. I mean, presumably he wasn't at home eating Pop-Tarts for 3 months or something. I mean, that sounds pretty cool, but I mean, it's not great if you're going to be athletic. I think it was just a complete failure of imagination in a degree. It's like, okay, we need to fill these holes. We lost James Shields. Country Breakfast is going to the West Coast. What's the laziest way we can squander our money? And that's what they had. I did a cartoon of Dayton Moore being visited by ghosts last year. I don't know if you guys remember that. And I had a picture of the Ghost of Christmas Future showing him Edinson Volquez. And it came to be.
So already your predictions
I would worry about.
Hold some strong value here.
Yeah, the other two pictures in that were of Willie Bloomquist and Michael Young, so you better watch out because he could come out of retirement.
Or Chris Getz, he's still in the area.
He feels like a Royal.
Yeah, Michael Young.
Just think of Michael Young.
Oh yeah.
And his AL MVP vote from 2012.
Oh, we've talked about that on the show. We're just like, that just feels like a move that Dayton really is aching to make.
Really, none of these signings destroy the team. If they're lousy, they'll lose time. They're not going to win 65 games because of Kendrys Morales and Alex Rios. But it's such just a failure of imagination. I know I said that word before, but it just seems like the laziest thing to do. If the Royals were ever going to make a big investment in a star player, this was the offseason it would happen. And I thought going into this offseason that it was really the time that they had to, you know, because at some point you have to take the gamble, put your best foot forward. If you go back to the playoffs, I mean, the excitement at Kauffman was just incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, these were fans, and you guys too, that have no adult memory of a good Royals team. It's kind of been like a dormant market to an extent, kind of just, you know, the longtime losers. And there was serious interest for a good Royals team. And this is the time that you have to keep these fans, because if the Royals win 78 games in 2015, 79 games next year, all this will be for nothing. I think this was kind of the time to make new fans. I mean, yeah, you're not going to go out and sign John Lester and Max Scherzer and just bring them all, but you could have made more of an effort to bring in back James Shields at least. At least showed the fans that have shown interest in the team that the team is interested in them. And they didn't do that this offseason. It was just, again, a lazy failure of imagination.
Yeah, and it is kind of unfortunate because we talked about this as it was happening, you know, especially that wild card game. I mean, when, you know, I was born the year the Royals won the World Series, so I literally have no memory of anything even close. And so, but, you know, thinking more about kids that are in that like 10, 11, 12, the really impressionable sports age, if you will. I mean, when I was that old, the Royals were really starting their downslide and the Chiefs were really good. And that was, you know, Marty Schottenheimer was fully in, and Carl Peterson were fully engaged, and they really, so people of my generation are bigger Chiefs fans. And so then we were talking about that for the World Series and all the cool stuff that was happening, that magic was creating new Royals fans. And yeah, you know, it was, we kind of recognized around here, you know, just not only us, but, you know, the all the sports talk shows and everything, that it was an important season. So it's interesting to get an outside, kind of an outsider's perspective, see that it was kind of a disappointing one, because it's gotten kind of mixed reviews. I don't know
it's milk toast.
Yeah, that's a perfect, like, yes.
Yeah, I mean, they just kind of plugged holes. I can kind of, I think we've talked ourselves into liking the offseason a little more than the initial reaction, because
I'd agree with that.
We're fans and we want it to turn out well, so it's like, well, maybe Rios was hurt.
Yeah.
Maybe Morales can bounce back.
Maybe the playoff is wrong. And
yeah, but, you know, I think when you look back at it, I'm not looking forward to 2015 to see what Edinson Volquez does. I want to see what Yordano Ventura does. I want to see if Eric Hosmer can actually, you know, hit 20 homers for a change, and if Sal Perez actually gets a day off and things like that. I want to see those guys. I'm pretty indifferent towards Rios and Morales and all those guys. So I think it's pretty accurate. I think you got a lot of blowback on that, though, Dan, from a good amount of Royals fans. Do you, is there any rephrasing from the original tweet that brought out?
Never. Never. I never rephrase anything.
Right.
See, the thing about me is I'm not paid to be warm and fuzzy. I'm not paid to be optimistic about a team or to encourage people to watch things. I'm kind of paid to be sarcastic and objective and almost cruel about it. And so I've been ragging on the Royals. I think right even during the World Series, I was ragging about their future lazy offseason, because I did predict that it would be a disappointing offseason. I was right there. But, of course, it's not that big a stretch. It's Dayton Moore.
I was just about to say, as hard as baseball players are to predict, Dayton Moore might be one of the easiest general managers to predict in baseball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How many times did we mention Edinson Volquez?
Oh, Lord.
This winter.
Yeah, I always kind of hope that in his post-GM career, Dayton Moore doesn't get a job with ESPN, because I'd have a lot of apologies to make. Because I've probably written about 20 Dayton Moore-related cartoons. He's probably my favorite GM to rag on, even more than Ruben Amaro.
Ruben Amaro is almost like picking on this low kid in class.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like, that's just not even fair. But Dayton Moore, it's like you can kind of see the wheels turning, but I just the first thing I think I ever saw from you was the picture of Dayton Moore dumping money in a toilet.
Oh yeah, that was one of my early Billy cartoons. I have a whole series of Billy cartoons where a little kid writes letters to Dayton Moore. And it shows how long he's been around. But it's easy to rag on a GM when their team is winning 69 games. It requires a real bastard to bash them while they're in the World Series.
So I
relish that role.
So tell us what you really think about Dayton Moore.
I think he's a better GM than Amaro is, and I think he's a better GM than Ed Wade was.
Okay, I mean, because
that's a big jump.
Well, that was before last year. That was kind of the line on Dayton Moore. Well, not necessarily that, but this idea that he was great for getting the Royals out of that cellar, out of crawling out of the dumpster that was on fire, and into a respectable level. But that in order to get to that, take that next step, like he himself kept talking about, that they would need somebody else with kind of a different philosophy. But now, that'll never happen. Dayton Moore he's written his card for as long as he wants it here. Was that kind of your impression all along, or did you even think that Dayton Moore was right from the start?
I think he does get some credit. The thing is, Dayton Moore, he was a really good scouting guy. He was, he was the director of international scouting for the Braves for a long time. He was a good scouting guy, and sometimes a good scouting guy isn't going to become a good GM. I have a high opinion of myself, and I'd be an absolutely terrible GM. I'm too excitable and disagreeable. It wouldn't work. The Braves had another scout similar to Dayton Moore that had a same kind of experience, in Chuck Lamar, who was a scouting guy who was put into a position of responsibility with Tampa Bay, and he was a terrible GM. And I was saying during the World Series that now the sad news for Royals fans is that you're never going to get rid of Dayton Moore or Ned Yost now. Never. They're folk heroes now.
Well, we were talking, if they if had the Royals won the World Series, I mean, sometime by midseason, Ned Yost is going to be the winningest Royals manager, or winningest manager in Royals history. And, I mean, you would have had to – they still might. But, I mean, you would have had to retire his number at that point, right? I mean, could you imagine that? Ned Yost's number sitting on the outfield. And because he would have won his – a World Series and been the winningest manager and managed the most games in Royals history. It's like – I mean, you almost have to, but just that, it's just such a weird concept living in the time. Maybe I'll look back on it. Maybe the Ned Yost era more fun.
Yeah, I mean, you see Ned Yost's number on the wall, and you're like, oh, that's a slow century. Ha-cha-cha-cha-cha.
Exactly. That's pretty much it. Oh, man.
Yeah, they'd have a statue. Probably Ned Yost sitting in a tree stand would be the statue I'd pick.
There you go, with Jeff Foxworthy.
Right.
Because naturally, all Ned Yost stories have to involve Jeff Foxworthy.
They do now that it got national attention.
Yes.
Just how it goes.
But the thing is, Ned Yost probably didn't do the worst job managing in the playoffs. There was some pretty bad managing.
Yeah, I
was actually... And
I mean, you...
Go ahead.
Remember Mattingly and the Dodgers? Remember the, I can't use my closer unless it's official? And Brad Ausmus did the same thing. Because Al Albuquerque, he's a six-inning guy. I can't use him in the seventh or other way around. But it was that kind of – even Yost didn't do that.
Yeah, he actually learned. That's typically been his pattern, but he at least adjusted I think if you look at their bullpen in the playoffs, it was basically 90% of the innings were covered by Herrera, Davis, and Holland, and a few by Finnegan, other than, you know, where they were getting their, you know, kicked around against the Giants this couple games. So he learned there. Interesting to see. It, probably not something he can sustain through a whole year, obviously, but it'd be nice if he could try. So they are saying that they might do an 8-man bullpen, which is okay. We'll see.
Yeah, what's your give us your thoughts on it?
I don't know what could be done about it, but I really hate modern bullpen usage. I hate the constant, you know, the just the churning of the managers and. I hate lefties. Damn you, Tony La Russa. What have you done? What have you just foisted upon us? I think that bullpens have, despite the increased number of personnel, that bullpen usage has gotten even more inflexible. Now you have to have the 6-inning guy, the 7-inning guy, the 8-inning guy, the 9-inning guy, the guy when the closer fails, blah, 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 blah. I think it's really just lazy managing, paint by numbers.
Yeah.
That kind of managing, you could have a computer do that easily. If that's your creative mind, just say, okay, he's got a 6 by his name, so he pitches the 6 in. I mean, you're not really managing. You're doing one of those little coloring books that give you when you're 4 that tell you, okay, start your crayon here, go to 1, then connect to 2, connect to 3, and oh, look, it's a pony! That's the kind of managing it is. I'd like to see, you know, more long relievers, because there's a lot of situations where you have to have guys that aren't just going to go 1 inning or ooh, he went 5 batters. He's the long man.
Yes. I stretch just him out it, too far now.
And it ruins the creativity when every manager is doing the same. It's because what will happen is nobody ever gets fired if their proven closer fails. They get fired if they try something creative and it fails.
That's exactly right. What... Ned Yost, back in, what was this? This is before 2011. I was on this blogger panel talking to Ned Yost at one of the Royals Fan Fest things. And at the time, Joaquin Soria was a closer. And, you know, everybody wanted to see Joaquin Soria come in, you know, in the typical fireman spots. And so we asked him that. We were like, have you ever thought about using him in a situation in the 7th if it really means the game, or do you still want to save him to the 9th? He's like, that's a really, really good idea, and we've thought about doing it, but you're not going to see me do it. It's like, all right, baseball orthodoxy, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, it's lame.
It is
lame. Yeah, and you get it gives managers an out, kind of like what you were saying, where they can – they're never held accountable if the proven closer fails, where it's just like, well, and we were scared going into the playoffs because Ned Yost had said those kind of exact things, like what Mike was just saying, you know, Aaron Crow's our 6th inning guy. You know, people were like, why didn't you put Kelvin? There was a certain game. It was like, why didn't you put Kelvin Herrera in the 6th inning or whatever? And it's like, well, Kelvin Herrera's a 7th inning guy. Aaron Crow's our 6th inning guy. If our starter doesn't go 6 innings, and it's just like, so it kind of gives them this faux out that allows them to just kind of escape blame, because it's like, well, at least I'm consistent, which is
it's like, why are you being paid if you can't make a decision? I mean, you could have a trained orangutan do it then. Yeah, I mean, I've seen the smart ones that live among us and hit buttons. I mean,
they can do sign language. They know like 300 words. That's all you need to signal the bullpen, right? But then you've got, you know, guys like Joe Maddon who get praised quite often, but they're the guys that step outside the box, you know. And, you know, then you hear, actually, this is kind of a good segue into a more general baseball topic that Mike and I have talked about. Joe Maddon seemingly kind of popularized those massive shifts as one of the things that he's kind of the outside the box thinking, if you will. But to just go on that tangent for a second, what's your thoughts on the new commissioner talking about possibly outlawing shifts and basically saying, to hell with all the numbers and the research that all these teams have done, you know, we want more offense?
It's obnoxious. One, there's absolutely no reason to think that that it's been a significant player in the decrease in offense. Because righties, their offenses has dropped almost to the same degree that it lefty hitters has. And really, lefty hitters already have a slight advantage of their own in that they're slightly closer to first base anyway. So what's the big deal? It's not responsible for the lack of offense. It's not responsible for the strikeout, certainly. It's not like having the extra dude on the side makes you strike out, and strikeouts keep going up every year. That's a much bigger deal than any shift thing. It's nonsense. It just robs baseball of any kind of, you know, tactical thinking. Because baseball doesn't really have the same tactical variety that a football team has. Really, the plays are almost by rote in baseball to a great degree. And the shifts really mix it up a bit. It makes it more interesting. And I think that it would be a shame to take it away.
Yeah, because, I mean, there were countless times where we were in the postseason, and up comes Mike Moustakas, and there was literally, you draw a line from home plate to second base, and every infielder was to the right of second base on the first base side. And it's just like, just hit it to left field, please. You know, you're going to have a double if you just hit it, if you hit a blooper to shallow left field, and he just didn't do it. So it's like, that was my biggest thing is that the onus is on the hitter to make them pay for making that tactical move, as you said, and you're letting them off the hook.
Exactly. Have you ever seen an NFL quarterback throw into quadruple coverage and then after the play stamp his foot and say, "It's not fair. Brought in another defensive back. It's not fair to me.
Yes,
I would have turned the ball there."
Cover two will be illegal starting in 2015
in
the NFL. You'll
be in jail.
That's exactly what it sounds like.
Yeah, it's like there's a solution to if someone's shifting against you, there's a big hole over there on the side of the infield that you could hit it to. There's nobody there.
Literally nobody.
Doctor, it hurts when I do this. Well, stop doing that.
Don't do that. so we'll bring it back to the Royals here, and kind of as we wrap this up, there's a lot of numbers that you've projected, and you know, a lot of it looks pretty similar to last year. But if you were to have one player, just kind of, you know, based on your inclination and the research you've done, that you would say would outperform and possibly, you know, highly outperform their numbers, who's your best candidate that you have
okay.
all the Royals to...
I think the candidate for greatly outperforming or greatly underperforming are the same guy. Eric Hosmer, I'm going to strangle him. what do you project from the rest of the year? What do you project from this year? Like, I have no idea. Sips is making this up. He has no idea what he's going to do.
I don't think he knows either.
Oh, he doesn't.
Every time I say something nice about him, he hits 200 for a month with no power, and then I give up on him, and then all of a sudden he starts hitting again. And I'm not even a Royals fan. It's like, why are you torturing a non-Royals fan? I mean, what kind of sick game are you playing?
It is an odd year. He seems to be having that odd, even kind of thing going, where he's you know, hit well in 2011 and 2013 and had off years the others. So,
and you watch him, and you think, he should be a lot better than he is. I mean, take another someone who's been disappointing, more disappointing than Hosmer, Justin Smoak. You don't really look at Justin Smoak hit and think, man, he should be much better than that. You think, no, man, why are they playing Justin Smoak? Mariners are insane. Yeah. Now the Blue Jays are insane. But Hosmer, you look at me and think he should be better than he is. And he's not, and it's such a frustrating thing for me as a non-Royals fan. So I can't imagine how frustrating it is for Royals fans to see him and wonder why he's not better.
It's rough, because that's one of the things when he came up was everyone was saying he looks like a superstar, which
he
the
does.
Royals haven't had. The Royals have
he
not
looks
had
like
that.
A baseball player.
He's the face of the franchise. Alex Gordon's the best player, but the guy who does all the media is Eric Hosmer, the guy who they feature on the new MLB The Show highlight package for PlayStation is Eric Hosmer. He's in there like three times in their little clip. So he's the guy, and you know, I think everybody gets Eric Hosmer jerseys and everything, but you know, the 10,000 people who did walk up tickets the day he debuted in Kansas City are really kind of, they've been disappointed at this point, I think, and he's extremely frustrating because he looks like the prototypical 300, 30, 100 Don Mattingly type of number kind of guy, and he's not. And
well, he is like Don Mattingly, just the wrong side of Don Mattingly's
right.
career.
There you go. Well said.
He has a fictional back injury that's hindered him. Now, if it doesn't work out, maybe Lorenzo Cain can be the face of the franchise, because Lorenzo Cain admittedly has a great name.
Yeah.
He sounds like someone who should be, you know, the tortured hero of the baseball movie, Lorenzo Cain. they have more
character
options.
And that was, he's the guy that pisses other people off when they play the team. Like, cause I mean, there were so many times in the playoffs where you see, you know, on Twitter, fans of other teams like, God, Lorenzo Cain again, you know, he's just making catch after catch. So he can kind of play that guy you hate, you know, hate playing against, but love him when he's on your team type of thing, just because he's so good at defense.
Yeah, so really, anything that Eric Hosmer does next year, it would not surprise me. If he had MVP-type season, I wouldn't be shocked. If he had a 650 OPS and he got shipped off with wherever the Kaihu brothers go, I wouldn't be shocked at that either. It was Kila and Kala and I can't even pronounce their names. Kaihui. Okay.
Yep.
And they always seem to float around, but I wouldn't be surprised if that happened to Hosmer either. He could be Eric Kaihui.
The long-lost third brother.
Eric Kaya.
Yes. Kaya. So with that, we're going to wrap up with one last thing. For those who follow Dan on Twitter, and if you don't, you should. Why don't you give – I don't want to butcher the spelling of your name, so why don't you give your Twitter handle so people can follow you.
Well, you think spelling my name is easy for me? It's like, geez, I mean, you know, I have to do this all the time. Give me a break. I'm DZMBORSKI on Twitter. That's DZYMBORSKI. If you have the first few letters, like the D, the S, the Z, and the Y, Google will figure it out, because Google
there you
can
go.
Do that.
Google's pretty
and
smart.
And now that Zimborska in Poland is dead, I'm the Alpha Zimborski. So Google will find us.
There you go.
Alpha Zimborski.
Alpha Zimborski. By Philip
There's a Dan Zimborski in Michigan, and it's my mission in life to find him and defeat him.
There can only
yes,
be one.
I've been getting Google alerts a lot lately because there's apparently some Jeff Herr somewhere, maybe in Ohio, who's like a high school basketball coach, and he had a story written about him. So I every couple of days now I keep getting these pings for whatever reason. But but for those who do follow, and if you don't, you should, because as he's already mentioned, he's sarcastic and funny, and he tries to he might rile some Royals fans up every now and then, but it happens.
I rile up people from every team. I'm equal opportunity. I mean, I'm an Orioles fan, and I'm pretty mean to the Orioles too.
There you go. But anyway, the last year, Dan, you came up with you created these homemade Hearthstone baseball cards. For those who don't know, Hearthstone is a digital card battle game similar to like a Magic the Gathering type of thing. And you're apparently a big fan, if I recall. And made
oh, I am.
And made these cards. So we got to update the Dayton Moore card now, because lots have happened since. I think your card was it. We're talking about this before we started recording, but was it once played must wait 7 or 8 turns before it could play again, or so something?
I'd have to find it. These early cards, we had some balance issues. They wouldn't play in the game. The Billy Bean card, for instance, you draw too many cards. It would be an unfair card to play in game. So I've been working. I made a Jonah Carey card, which I felt was pretty fair, and I made a whole bunch of Canadians, so they have, you know, that Canadian synergy. Because in Hearthstone,
played together.
In Hearthstone, different creatures have synergy with each other. You know, dragons, mechs, these weird water things called murlocs. They all have synergy with each other. And so I made all the Canadian cards have synergy, so you could have Canadian
powers. But yeah, that's got to be our goal here for 2015. We got to update the Dayton Moore card and maybe the Ned Yost card as well. After a World Series run, I think it's due.
I might have made a Yost. Did I make a Yost one too? It seems like something I would have done.
I feel like you did. That's what I think. That's what
I made a fake Jeopardy question. I know I made a fake Jeopardy question for him.
What was your fake Jeopardy question? I don't know if I saw that.
I'll have to find it. But see, that's the fun of a podcast. We can speak about things that we're looking at that the people listening can't see.
Indeed.
Extra cool. A little time. I think we've live podcasted a game at some point without the express written consent of
Baseball. So. I did make a Ned Yost Hearthstone card because I got it now. Battlecry plays a random reliever from your deck. Death Rattle, sacrifice one of your minions and do one damage to a random enemy. And this was a more balanced card than the Dayton Moore one.
That's fantastic. Anytime you can use the word sacrifice on a Ned Yost Hearthstone card, you're winning.
Just gives me bad memories of Alcides Escobar giving away an out to Madison Bumgarner. It's like, doesn't need the help.
Doesn't need it.
Probably was going to get him out anyway, but, you know.
You know, we'll never know. Now we'll never know. It's true. Just like if Gordon should have gone home.
No, we'll know that. we know that.
Mike, don't crush my dreams, Mike. Don't do this to me. We'll never know, okay? So I think with that, we're gonna wrap up the show. Dan, thank you so much for coming on the show and giving us nearly an hour of your time, plus however much time we spent working out our gremlins off air. Really appreciate you coming on. Had a blast this show. You've been a great guest. We'll have to get you back on again during the season if you have time.
Oh, sure. Had a fun time, guys. You have a good one.
All right, absolutely. You have a fantastic night. And this, everybody, thanks for stopping by. This has been the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn. I, of course, am your host, Jeff Herr, for Michael Engel, and our guest tonight, Dan Zimborski. Thank you so much for listening, and as always, go Royals.
You have been listening to a Royals Podcast Network presentation.
I gotta check my Dayton Moore card.
Yeah, I remember I can't remember when it was last year. I want to say it was around like July or whatever when you were doing that, Dan. And
I still do occasional ones.
Yeah,
but I didn't want to beat the joke to death.
Right. Yeah, I know you feel because like I gave you credit for it. And I was like, this is an excellent idea. And then I tried to do a couple of my own and. Like, I just had a blast doing it. I think I made, like, four, and then I had to stop myself for the same reason. I was like, I don't want to be that guy right now. But
because then you realize at some point your Twitter's become a one-joke account, and you can't say anything else forever. You're just...
Exactly. You're the Hearthstone card guy.
Yeah, the joke Hearthstone cards guy. I'll see you guys on Twitter. I sent you a link.
I just saw that. I picked up my phone, the poetry...
Yeah, that was an old one. This was from, like, 2003 or 2004. But it's one of my favorite things. When Baseball Think Factory did more content, we used to do previews, and we got one writer. He did the entire preview. It was just that poem, and it really works if you have a chance to look through it.